From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump's hard line on immigration hits close to home.
The president said he was only taking criminals out of this country, and my dad doesn't have any criminal records.
Plus, what the Republican health care plan would cost Massachusetts, and what Don Trump Jr.'s Russia meeting could cost his dad. It's all part of our Week in Review.
Most people would have taken that meeting. It's called opposition research, or even research into your opponent.
Also today, the Yankees are back in Boston to kick off the second half of the baseball season. But is that Red Sox-Yankees rivalry still as intense as it once was? And
my baby, baby star, baby star.
Suitcase junket, a grease pole tournament, and other things to do on a summer weekend in July. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with the local impact of President Trump's immigration policy. This was a scene yesterday outside of Boston City Hall where a crowd of protesters demanded the release of Francisco Rodriguez, an undocumented immigrant who'd been working as a janitor at MIT and who now faces deportation. Rodriguez fled gang violence in his native El Salvador and came to the U.S. in 2006. Immigration authorities denied his asylum request but granted him prosecutorial discretion and allowed him to stay in the country, where he's been working and where he now has two U.S.-born children, including his 10-year-old daughter, Melanie, who spoke at yesterday's rally.
The president said he was only taking criminals out of this country, and my dad doesn't have any criminal records. I hope, and I'm going to pray for my dad to be together with all my family again.
And here's Greg Romanofsky, chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
This administration seems more keen on scoring political points by picking up everyone they can find. And the easiest people to find are usually the good folks who report to their appointments and otherwise follow the government's instructions.
Now, Rodriguez could be deported in the next couple of weeks. Here to discuss this case and the rest of the week's news are Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, same here. Thank you.
And John Carroll, professor of communication at BU and WBUR senior news analyst. Hello to you, John.
Hello, Anthony.
So let's start with that story that we were just setting up there. Incredibly emotional, but reactions about the detention and possible deportation of people like Francisco Rodriguez. John.
This is the parallel universes that we live in now. I mean, this plays really well with the Trump base, and it plays really badly with a whole lot of other people. This is what Donald Trump promised to do. And essentially, he doesn't worry about the backlash from people who are not his supporters. What he's doing is basically setting the table for the people who do support him. And they have no problem with this.
Yeah, now, Arlene, I mean, I hear what John's saying. On the other hand, Trump promised to deport bad hombres. I mean, this guy doesn't sound like a bad hombre to me. So it is a sort of case of real dissonance here.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, this poor man is... This is a heartbreaking story. The poor man is certainly no slouch. He's active member of his church, of his kids' school, within the community. He has a full-time job, and then he runs his own business on the side, so he's creating jobs for others. He's the quintessential example of what you want new residents of this country to be all about. So, yeah, he's far from a bad hombre. And I think this highlights the fact that the Trump administration sort of has a abandon all humanity and decency, if you will, when it comes to deportation issues. Discretion that they used to exercise in previous administration has flown out the window. It's disappeared. They have like a harsh, scorched earth deportation policy now. And the irony in this particular case is that this poor guy was following all the rules of ICE. He was, you know, checking in when he asked to. He was showing up at his court dates. He was waiting for his chance to apply for permanent status. So this is a real indictment of the administration's handling of immigration, of these folks.
I want to point out a couple of things from the other side of the ledger, so to speak. So Greg Romanofsky, chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, says that immigration officials are acting within their authority by detaining Rodriguez, who does have a removal order. A spokesman for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement issued a statement saying that Rodriguez was notified in June that he would need to make arrangements to leave the country. And according to the statement, he failed to do so. So there is the sort of case of the law. But, John, I mean, how do we make sense of that?
Well, there is no making sense of it because it's Donald Trump. So, I mean, in the case of DACA, the Dreamers, he has not cracked down on deporting them. Mm-hmm. He has left that alone pretty much, and it's pretty much status quo from where the Obama administration was. On the other hand, he's working with two Republican senators to reduce legal immigration by half over the next 10 years. So he's all over the place, which is typical of Donald Trump. So to look for consistency from him, to look for him even to back up the things he says about the, you know, sending out the bad ones and leaving the good ones alone, it's a fool's errand because he is not going to be consistent in a way you expect an average politician to be consistent. This is all ad hoc. This is all flying by the seat of his pants.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration's temporary ban on travelers from six Muslim countries took another hit this week. So a judge in Hawaii ruled that grandparents and other relatives of people living in the U.S. should be exempt from the travel ban. So this essentially is a narrowing of this travel ban. Arlene, what's your response to that?
Well, you know, when the Supreme Court originally dealt with this question a few weeks ago, they talked about the fact that it imposed, quote, a concrete hardship on individuals, on companies, on schools, on organizations like hospitals. But nonetheless, they left it in place. I really laughed when I read the line from the decision that came out of Hawaii, where they talk about it being the antithesis of the Trump administration's interpretation is the antithesis of common sense. You know, to deny that they said grandparents are the epitome of close family members, and to pretend otherwise is just crazy. And the moral majority, the family values, the religious right folks should be the first to recognize that.
Right. Now, all of this comes as the U.S. Supreme Court prepares to review the constitutionality of the travel ban. Where do you see this going, John? Where do you see this playing out? How do you see this playing out?
It's hard to tell because the way it was drafted was so haphazard and so slapdash that I think it left an opening for the lower courts to essentially void the travel ban because it wasn't disciplined enough. There are arguments that say a president does have wide-ranging powers to decide who gets into the country and who doesn't. But because of Trump's statements on the campaign trail, and that's something I think the Supreme Court's going to address, because to render federal judicial decisions based on what someone says on the campaign trail as opposed to based on the Constitution and the laws of the country is pretty unusual. So I think they may step in on that. But they may look and say, if this were drafted in a different way, it would be legitimate. It would be within the bounds of the Constitution. So I think it's going to be interesting because I think there's a lot of different ways the court could go on this.
Hmm. I wish Americans knew American history a little bit better, myself included, by the way. There was a great video I saw on YouTube recently. A Tufts University, a former professor named Sol Gittleman gave a lecture on immigration and race about a month or so ago, and I recommend people take a look at it. It's a funny but instructive look at how America treats people in 2017, a look at how people are treated based on immigration and race in this country, and it's eye-opening for everyone except Native Americans because all the rest of us are immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One footnote to this, the Hawaii decision also opened the door for refugees who have a relationship with a resettlement agency, which the Trump administration had closed. And it's crazy because refugees can't come here without that relationship. And what the court had said was a bona fide relationship with a person or entity. And the Hawaii court said basically that's an entity that's a legitimate one for refugees. So they don't need now to have a relationship in the country, refugees. They just have to have a deal or an arrangement set up with a resettlement agency.
So, of course, all this takes place, and we're talking about it as this explosive political story continues to dominate the news in Washington this week. So I want to talk about that, about the revelations of Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian attorney who he believed was going to dish out dirt on Hillary Clinton before last year's election. "I love it," Trump Jr. wrote in one of his emails leading up to that meeting, attended by his brother-in-law, Jared Kushner, and then campaign manager Paul Manafort. And we're learning today that there were other people at that meeting as well. So this deepens the drama and the investigations engulfing the Trump administration, and words like collusion, conspiracy, even treason are suddenly being thrown around in Washington. So here's Virginia Senator and former Hillary Clinton running mate Tim Kaine.
Nothing is proven yet, but we're now beyond obstruction of justice in terms of what's being investigated. This is moving into perjury, false statements, and even into potentially treason.
Now, speaking in France during an official state visit this week, President Trump tried to play down the significance of all of this.
Most people would have taken that meeting. It's called opposition research, or even research into your opponent.
Now, for his part, Trump Jr. says the meeting amounted to nothing, but he did suggest to Fox News this week that maybe it was a meeting he should have skipped.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out.
Okay, so Arlene, let me start this way. Probably not treason. People get executed for that, but we're probably talking about something a little more serious than opposition research. What do you make of what we've learned this week?
You know, someone I know said recently that they were their view is informed by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She said, "How do you lie to me? Let me count the ways." Donald Trump Jr., 1. Jared Kushner, 2. Michael Flynn, 3. Paul Manafort, 4. Carter Page, Roger Stone, Jeff Sessions. All these people denied having any meetings with the Russians until they decided to not deny it because they slowly had to admit they had it when they were confronted with evidence that, yes, the meetings took place. It's a drip, drip, drip. You know, something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
And speaking of drip, 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 there were more drips today. A Russian-American lobbyist, a veteran of Russia's military, I'm probably going to get this name wrong, Renat Akhmetshin, said today that he attended the June 2016 meeting between Trump's eldest son and the Kremlin-connected attorney. And now we're learning that there might have been one or two other people at that meeting as well. So as Arlene says, John, drip, drip, drip. What do you make of what we learned this week?
Well, first of all, Junior has had more stories than John Updike, so that really hurts. But this is very much the Clinton playbook, which is to tell the truth a little bit at a time. Except the Clintons were really good at it, and the Trump people are really bad at it. So I think what's happening here is that there are basically two stories emerging. One is the story, the narrative that the Democrats want to craft. And it's not just Tim Kaine. It was also Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton who was talking about treason. I think that's not the most politic way to go about this. They're hyping it up in a way that I think overstates to some degree what's there. What's there is serious and potentially damaging, but it's potentially damaging. And I think that a lot of people are getting out in front of this story when and some of it's wishful thinking and some of it is just politics as usual in terms of hyping up a story. But I think that a lot of people would be advised to sit back, let Robert Mueller do what he does, let this thing play out in some kind of rational, reasoned way, and then come to conclusions.
Because I'm not sure if I agree with that, though. You know, I got to tell you, because I think we've been letting him off the hook an awful lot. And I'm not talking about going into hysteria mode, but I have friends who voted for Trump, and I have urged them to think through what if it was inverse. What if it was a foreign country, a hostile country, a country hostile to the United States who was helping to elect a Democrat as president of the United States? We would, they would, hopefully everyone would be outraged by it. It's so fundamentally wrong.
But we don't live in that world anymore. We live in Trump world. Hmm. And in Trump world, the normal doesn't apply in so many cases.
Well, let me
think of all the things he's denormalized. So to basically apply Clinton-esque standards to Trump is, again, you know, it's a fool's errand because it's just not going to work. Those things don't stick to him.
What about the defense that you hear from some Trump defenders who talk about the idea that we're dealing with political outsiders? I mean, could it be that the Trump administration was simply inexperienced, a bit naive? I mean, it seems like Don Trump Jr. is sort of being presented as you know, that's what the issue was. Come on, good guy. He meant well. He just went to a meeting. He was just working for his dad. He didn't know. These people don't know.
Boy, I know a lot of people who have been brought up on criminal charges who would love to be able to use that excuse and get away with it. And most of them are not necessarily college educated or master's degree people. So, you know, they can't have it both ways. If they want to apply that rule to themselves, they'd have to apply it all the way down the criminal justice system. And these folks absolutely do not do that.
Yeah.
But some people aren't naive. They're grifters. And this was a good grift. This was had the potential to pay off in a major way for Donald Trump. 2 hours after Donald Trump Jr. made the appointment to meet with these Russians, Donald Trump gave a speech where he said, I'm going to have a major speech on Hillary Clinton, where you're going to have all kinds of dirt in terms of how she turned the State Department into a personal hedge fund by, you know, extorting money from all these different countries for the Clinton Foundation. That speech never happened. And whether that was a coincidence or not is hard to tell. But you start putting all these things together, and it certainly looks like people knew more than they're saying they knew.
So let me ask this. I mean, I take your point, John, that you made a short while ago that, you know, we've got a sort of all cool down, let Mueller do his job and figure this out. But in the meantime, what's this doing to any political agenda in Washington? I mean, for example, you know, we just had a major state visit to France by an American president. We're not talking about that right now because this just seems to obliterate everything.
And this is what's driving Donald Trump crazy, which is why he's raging around the White House and watching TV 17 hours a day, because basically this has sidetracked everything. And the only things that get through, what got through from the French visit that he either complimented or insulted Macron's wife, so the First Lady of France. So that's what got through, virtually nothing else. You know, it's swallowing everything at this point.
The one good thing I think is coming out of this is the unintended consequences that I think that people are starting to remember the importance of having a robust press. You know, I have friends who complain about having to subscribe to a newspaper, or they never get around to making a contribution to WBUR or whatever it is. But I think that people are beginning to remember now how important it is to have a vibrant press corps, because we wouldn't know any of these things if it were not for a very professional and successful press.
Well, part of the Republican agenda in Washington is trying to move forward. So I want to talk about that. And that's the Senate Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Republicans unveiled a revised proposal which would allow insurers to sell new low-cost stripped-down policies. It would also keep some taxes on high-income people in place and provide a whole lot more money to fight opioid addiction. But it would still dramatically reorganize and cut, by any other word, it's a cut Medicaid. So Maine Senator Susan Collins, a Republican, says she can't support it.
If the provisions that completely overhaul the Medicaid program were dropped from the bill, that would be a great step in the right direction.
Meanwhile, conservative Rand Paul says he won't vote for the plan because it doesn't dismantle enough of the Obamacare taxes. So that means Mitch McConnell can afford to lose no more votes, or else this long-promised effort to kill Obamacare dies. What do you think? I'll start with you, Arlene. I mean, do you think McConnell can get the votes he needs?
Well, I don't underestimate him. He's been unfortunately rather successful. But I sure feel we're lucky in this state. We've got Senate and congressional delegation that will be 100% against a repeal of Obamacare. But for people who have family and friends in other states, states represented by Republicans in the Senate, now's the time to call them and ask them to help, because we are on the precipice and we could lose our ability to call ourselves a civilized society if we can consider ourselves that now. And the notion of kicking millions of people off health care is just despicable.
John, what do you see? Do you think what do you think? I mean, we're going to wait for the CBO score early next week. Then there's going to probably be a move toward a vote or at least a movement to debate. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I see it being very quiet up on Capitol Hill right now. And a number of senators who were ambivalent, uncertain, unwilling to back the bill in its previous form have been awfully quiet about this one. And so the question is, will there be that third vote? And who wants to be that third vote?
Yeah.
A lot of people thought it was going to be Dean Heller, the Republican senator from Nevada, who is very vulnerable in terms of reelection in 2018. Hillary Clinton won that state. But he's also been very quiet. There was a report in New York Magazine today that said the Republicans are basically buying him off. So one of the dynamics is if the third no emerges, then you'll probably get six or seven more no's. But if the third, if none of the people want to be the one who is the third no, who will face charges that you're the one who saved Obamacare, then this very well could get to the floor. What happens after it gets to the Senate floor is anybody's guess.
You know, I know I keep referring to people I know who voted for Trump, but it does inform how I approach these things. And I've said to some of them recently that if they do, in fact, support repeal of Obamacare, that they've got to think through the phrase, "There but for the grace of God go I." You know, what if I lost my job tomorrow and I therefore lost my health insurance, or my hours were cut back so I lost it, or what if my kids or my family experienced it? Or what if, like Jimmy Kimmel, my family had a baby born with a heart problem that requires treatment for the rest of his life? Or what if, like the two brothers in the Marathon bombing who lost legs and had no health insurance? You know, there but for the grace of God go I. And if just enough senators will think of it that way, we could stop this.
I want to ask you about the Democrats, though, and sort of the way the Democrats should or could be responding to this. So last week, I went up to New Hampshire with Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat from New Hampshire, and she visited a clinic, a rural clinic, and she brought the message that repealing Obamacare, bad thing. She had a very sympathetic audience there. A lot of people talked about how extra Medicaid dollars was making this clinic possible. And then she sat down and talked to doctors and nurses and providers and administrators, and she got an earful about what is wrong with the system right now. And there's a lot wrong with it. And I just felt like she didn't really have a good answer for that. And, you know, just high premiums, the high cost of prescription drugs, the degree to which medical providers have to bend over backwards and deal with a bureaucracy. So, you know, I understand why healthcare providers oppose cutting Medicaid, but I don't think the Democrats are offering a clear enough message about how to fix Obamacare, the system that's there now.
They don't see any advantage in that right now. Yeah. They're, you know, basically the rule is when your opponents are digging a hole, don't stop them from digging. So they're just letting the Republicans do whatever they're going to do. And they're making all these murmurings about how, you know, we're ready to cooperate if the Republicans want to, which means if the Republicans are desperate enough to. But they're not coming up with anything concrete because there's no edge in that for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that basically there are a whole bunch of ways you can look at Obamacare. But one way to look at it is it's a heck of a lot more popular than anything the Republicans have proposed up to this point.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to potentially lighter news. Let's turn to our hubbubs, those stories that didn't get much notice this week. Arlene, let me start with you. Your hubbub for the week.
My hubbub for this week is Hot Town, Summer in the City. There's so much that's going on in this city, and I'll mention just two. One, if you like music, there are free concerts in Boston City Hall Plaza every Wednesday night that range from Sinatra to disco to R&B to tributes to Stevie Wonder. And I'm told you can access the information on the Boston City website if you look at the Parks Department. Second item, exercise. If you need inspiration to do it, or you want to do it for free in outdoor programs, the Charles River Esplanade has something almost every night of the week, from Zumba to yoga to running clubs to body burning. I don't know what the heck that is. And I'm told that if you go to the Esplanade Association's website, you can register for these free classes. It's, in my mind, just another reason to love the city.
Good stuff. We're going to be actually talking about fun stuff to do this weekend, some of it free later in this hour, so stay tuned for that. John, your hubbub.
So my hubbub starts two Sundays ago, with an op-ed in the New York Times written by a Tufts professor named Eitan Hersh. I hope I pronounced his name right. And the headline was, "Political Hobbyists Are Ruining the Country." And basically what he was saying is people are looking, you know, through Facebook and a whole bunch of other means, looking at politics as sort of a leisure activity. And they're not doing the things that really need to be done in terms of supporting political organizations, that kind of thing. And he talks in particular about political fandom, where everybody's out there boosting the people who believe the same things they believe. Flash forward to a couple of days ago, and there's a letter to the editor in the New York Times. It says, "To the editor, political hobbyists are ruining the country. I cannot think of any political message more important than Eitan Hersh's eloquent plea to the left to get serious about organizing as opposed to spending so much time and energy cheering one another on." And it is signed, Barney Frank, Newton, Mass.
Okay.
So if anybody's worried about Congressman Frank in terms of his first ballot entry into the Hall of Curmudgeons, I think they can rest easy.
All right. So here's my hubbub. It's news that an episode of The Simpsons that was all about Boston has been nominated for an Emmy. And I want to thank our chief engineer here on Radio Boston, Tim Skog, for pointing this out to me. So the episode is called The Town. It's about a family trip the Simpsons take to Boston and includes lots of familiar references to our city, from candlepin bowling to colorful language and accents. So here's the premise. When Bart Simpson becomes a Boston sports fan, Homer, his dad, buys the family tickets to the city to show his son the error of his ways. So here's a brief clip.
A vacation to Boston?
No, not a vacation. A hatecation, where you experience the worst a place has to offer and then say, "Told ya! I've never loved hating anything so much!"
Move your garbage car! I gotta get to the packy before the bees drop puck!
Told ya!
Okay, a hatecation. So the episode was nominated for Outstanding Animated Series, and we'll know if it wins in September when the Emmy Awards take place. You'd vote for that, right, John?
Oh, sure.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Too highfalutin for me.
John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, have a great weekend. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. If a bill before the Massachusetts legislature becomes law, dozens of public schools in the states would have to change the names of their teams. That's because the bill would prohibit school mascots named after Native Americans. But as WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin tells us, Native Americans in Massachusetts are divided about the proposed plan.
At the annual powwow of the Wallamonapog Intertribal Council in Attleboro, dozens of Native people and their guests take time to dance, buy and sell goods, and talk. But ask about mascots, and you get steered to an elder.
But I have to find her. Usually she's sitting down.
Here, that elder is a woman named Whippoorwill. She recently turned 80, and she's wearing a baseball hat that says Native Pride. What does that mean to you?
That we should stand up and be proud of who we are.
But Whippoorwill sees no conflict between that pride and the three dozen or so Massachusetts schools that have teams called the Redmen, the Red Raiders, or the Indians. If anything, she says, it's a sign of respect.
Of course, you don't want your team to lose, so you pick on people that can stand up and be brave, and I think of it as a compliment.
The older powwow attendees agree. The mascots don't offend them if they're presented respectfully. But that isn't always the case, especially with younger Native people. As musicians play traditional music nearby, a group of teenagers are sitting on picnic tables in the shade. And they say they feel wounded by the mascots, like 13-year-old Kateri Silva. She says she's proud to be Native too, but that she hasn't felt a lot of respect coming from her classmates at school.
On the bus every single day, people will go "Ooh," like that, or go call me Pocahontas if I wear my hair in braids.
Silva and her friends agree that calling teams the Redmen feels like another way of singling Natives out, and ignoring their presence in modern-day America.
They wouldn't be like, oh, the yellow men. It's because we've been stomped on for so many years.
The debate over native-themed mascots dates back almost 50 years, but it's come to a head in Massachusetts this year after a group of citizens introduced a bill that would ban the practice at public schools statewide.
I've got to be honest with you. That old saying, it's political correctness, gone awry.
Representative Jim Miceli represents Tewksbury, home of the Redmen. He believes the bill is, quote, dead on arrival, in part because of the number of older Native people, like Whippoorwill, who came forward to tell legislators that they like the mascots.
I got calls from chiefs, and the chiefs said they had no objection to the use of the symbol. In fact, they considered it a compliment.
Among those supporting the ban is Claudia Fox Tree, an educator of Arawak descent. If natives of different ages disagree about the meaning of the mascots, she says, it's because young people are often hit harder than older ones.
Maybe it didn't damage us. Maybe we came to understand our identity as more of an adult with an adult brain. But the research is clear on how damaging these are.
Fox Tree points to psychological studies that suggest that mascots aren't neutral symbols. They have an effect on mood and behavior. Those studies suggest that young Native Americans respond to images like Chief Wahoo, the grinning red-faced mascot of the Cleveland Indians, with diminished self-esteem and less hope for the future. What's more, Fox Tree says the symbols force a paradoxical invisibility on natives like her. Most Americans know the cartoon mascots better than the real people they represent. So, she says, they bespeak a bigger problem.
What is known about us or written about us is someone else's story of us. Our own narrative has been taken from us.
That's the concern among Native students at UMass Amherst, too. For decades, UMass's mascot was Chief Metawampi, and the team was known as the Redmen before it was changed in 1972 after a wave of activism. Jasmine Goodspeed is a rising senior of Nipmuc heritage. Earlier this year, she lobbied to change the name of the Turner's Falls Indians. That's a high school nearby. She's used to older natives' opinions on team names like the Indians.
They don't care. There are so many other problems to worry about, so why worry about this one word?
But Goodspeed and her native classmates argue that language matters.
It's like, well, I think the word is part of the root of the problem. It's part of the erasure of our people.
Another recent issue involved a statue of Chief Metawampi still on campus. With other Native students, Andreas Ridley, a graduating senior of Wampanoag and Penobscot descent, considered asking to have the statue removed. But they decided instead to ask the university to add an educational plaque alongside it.
So that the statue is not a landscape ornament, but is a historical figure with a history.
In the same way, Ridley says, getting rid of Native mascots would represent progress, but it's only half the battle.
But what would be great is if we could follow up with that with a sincere curriculum of our history and our contemporary reality.
In Tewksbury, the Redmen may remain, but Representative Jim Miceli says that school officials have worked out a deal whereby Native leaders will come to town and teach that history once a year.
And that story from WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin.
I heard your mama sold your buttons on till you were 22. And your sister washed your laundry.
This time I did laundry too.
So this is the band Tank and the Bangas. And if you're looking for something to do this weekend, they'll be among the bands performing at the Green River Festival later today, tomorrow and Sunday, at Greenfield Community College out in Western Mass. Amelia Mason is music critic for WBUR's Artery, and she's here to talk about that and some other recommendations for fun things to do this weekend. Hello, Amelia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So this Green River Festival is the event you're most excited about. It's a two-hour drive from Boston, but you say it's worth it.
Yeah, I mean, they just do an incredible job with the lineup every year. It's created and presented by Signature Sounds, which is this independent label out in Western Mass, and they tend to skew towards sort of folk and Americana, but they do a really nice job mixing it up. I like the diversity they bring in genre-wise. So there's like a Cuban percussionist, and there's a band from Mali, and there's reggae, you know, along with all that sort of singer-songwriterly fare.
And Amelia, among those groups, Tank and the Bangas, which we opened the segment with, this is a group that won NPR's Tiny Desk contest for their song Quick. So tell us more about this band, what you like about them.
Yeah, they're from New Orleans, and they're kind of hard to describe in terms of genre. They're definitely like funk and hip hop, but they really stand out for their lead singer, the aforementioned Tank. She is so charismatic. And then the band itself is like super loose, but very precise. They have released a single of the song they won that contest with, Quick. Here's a taste. Next thing that I know, I was leaning, he was driving, so I gotta make a quick decision. Gotta get out my feelings, see that.
All right, the song Quick from Tank and the Bangas. Who else are you excited about at the Green River Festival?
So the Suitcase Junk is one I'm especially excited about. I've seen him live. It's a project by Matt Lorenz. He lives out there in Western Mass, and he is a one-man band. And he kind of has this sort of junkyard aesthetic. He like has collected all these pots and pans that he drums, you know, manipulates stuff with his feet while he's playing his guitar and singing. He kind of does these like uplifting sort of garage pop things and sort of bluesy, quieter things.
We should hear some. We've actually got some sound from Suitcase Junket. Here's the song Beta Star. Oh, hey, yeah, that you are, that you are, that you are. All right, Beta Star there from Suitcase Junket. That's they're going to be performing at the Green River Festival. So, Amelia, as we mentioned, Greenfield, 2 hours away in Western Massachusetts. So for folks who may be stuck closer to the city this weekend, you've got some other ideas.
I do indeed. The weather's looking pretty good. And the great thing about summer, there's always all this free stuff, like just free festivals you can wander through. So we have Somerville Art Beat in Davis Square. They shut down the square. All the vendors come out. All the restaurants are serving food outside. There's performing art and music. It's all free.
And this is all day Saturday, right?
That is all day Saturday. It actually starts tonight.
Great.
And then on Saturday and Sunday, we have Festival Batances, which is at Villa Victoria in the South End. It bills itself as New England's longest-running Latino cultural celebration. It is old. It's been going on for like 3 decades, full of music. There's a parade. But the thing that I think is most notable about it is this event.
All right. Sounds like they're having lots of fun. What are they doing?
That is the Greased Pole competition. That's from YouTube. It's from 2012.
The Greased Pole competition. Okay, you've got to tell me a little bit
about
this.
Okay, so full disclosure, I haven't seen it yet, but my colleague Greg Cook wrote a great piece about it. He interviewed one of the perennial winners of the competition, and it's just a giant utility pole greased up with Puerto Rican flags on the top, and teams of like 5 or 6 people. Basically, they time them. Who can get to the top the fastest? And the way they do that is by climbing on each other's shoulders. So there is a guy at the bottom who's like supporting
because
fire.
Because getting a grip on the greased pole might be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, you couldn't. Well, I mean, somebody might be able to actually climb up by themselves, but I don't know who that person is.
Okay, great recommendations from the Arteries, Amelia Mason. And get more information on all of those picks at RadioBoston.org. Amelia, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, baseball is back. And is the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry as white hot as it used to be? We're going to talk about that. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The All-Star break is behind us, and the second half of the baseball season resumes tonight. Here in Boston, the Red Sox, in first place in the American League East, are taking on the New York Yankees for four games, starting tonight and through the weekend. So before we talk a little bit about that, there was some Red Sox news today. The team is parting ways with third baseman Pablo Sandoval, who never really got going in Boston. Pandamania never really hit the city. That means they're cutting their losses after agreeing to pay him $95 million. We're going to take time now for a mid-season check-in and look at that historic Red Sox-Yankee rivalry. And to help me do that, I'm joined by Gordon Eads, longtime sports writer and now the Red Sox team historian. Gordon, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
So, as we mentioned, the Red Sox finished that first half of the season in first place, 3.5 games ahead of the Yankees. How do you think they're set up for going into this second half of the season?
I think that there are a lot of encouraging signs, Anthony, because the reality is that I think for the first 3 months of the season, we did not play our best baseball, and there were a lot of challenges. I mean, you lose David Rice for 2 months. Stephen Wright, we lost for the season. We've gone through eight third baseman, Anthony, right. and Hanley Ramirez has not been able to play first base. So for us to be at this position where to hold a 3.5 game lead going into the second half, and David Price now healthy, potentially forming a dominating 1-2 at the top of the rotation.
Right, I think with Chris Sale, who exactly. Arguably the best pitcher out there these days, that's a pretty powerful 1-2 punch.
Absolutely, there had been a lot of talk early in the season. You know, without David Ortiz, we didn't have the power in the lineup anymore. The team wasn't hitting home runs. I think a lot of that has been put to bed.
Let me ask you about that, because as folks know, if you do a little bit of reading, they're last in the American League in hitting home runs. So it seems like they really are missing David Ortiz.
Well, there's no question we're missing him, and you knew that. Not only do you not have David's presence in the middle of the lineup, but has a ripple effect on the entire lineup, Anthony. And I think that the encouraging thing in terms of the home runs is that we were so far dead last in home runs through the first 6-8 weeks of the season. That number's kind of picked up now. You're seeing Mookie hit home runs. You're seeing Jackie Bradley Jr. Hitting home runs. We'd like to see an increase in production from Hanley Ramirez. And by the way, you were too kind to Pablo Sandoval. We barely got one season out of him, and that season was dreadful. And $49 million, that's a tough nut to swallow, which is what he had remaining on his contract.
Now, just for folks who don't quite understand the intricacies of baseball contract, what does that mean? The Red Sox are on the hook for the rest of that contract no matter what?
So David Dombrowski has the next 10 days to either trade Pablo or release him. Well, another club is not going to trade for him, because then they'd be obligated to pick up his contract.
Yeah.
If the Red Sox release him, they're obligated to pay the $49 million that remains on the contract. Another team can sign him for the $500,000 major league minimum.
Yeah, well, over the years, there have been some great signings for Boston and a few bad ones, and that clearly is in the latter category. I want to talk to you a little bit about this series with the Yankees, which begins tonight, expand the conversation a little bit about this storied Red Sox-Yankees rivalry. And to help us do that, I want to introduce Mike Vaccaro. He's the lead sports columnist for the New York Post and author of Emperors and Idiots, the 100-year rivalry between the Yankees and the Red Sox from the very beginning to the very end of the curse. Mike Vaccaro, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
So, Mike, let me just start with you. Give us a little sort of mid-season update on the Yankees. Since mid-June, the Yankees have lost 18 of the 25 games they've played. Are Yankee fans worried about that? What's going on?
Well, I think they were such a surprise for so long. They expected them to be 15 games over 500. Four games up.
Mike, we got a tough cell phone connection with you. Let me just see if we can hear you right now.
Sorry.
No, I think we're losing you, Mike. Let's see if my producer can reestablish contact with you, and we'll try to get you back. So, Gordon Needs, let me ask you the same question. I mean, I know you sort of take a look at all of baseball. Where are the Yankees at?
Well, the Yankees got a huge dose of bad news today, Anthony. Michael Pineda, one of the key members of their starting rotation, has a rotator cuff injury, and Tommy John surgery is being recommended, which, of course, then means he's lost for the season. And if the Yankees had a readily identifiable weakness, it is in their starting pitching. So for them to lose Pineda, you alluded to the fact, I think they've in their last 35 games are 14-21, like you said, 7-18 since the middle of June. So they've been trending in the wrong way here for a while. And this is a huge series for them to try to keep the Red Sox from creating a good bit of separation. And without Pineda, that job's going to become a lot harder.
Right. So I guess one of the big sort of sources of excitement for the Yankees is this young, big, strong guy, Aaron Judge, who's on pace to hit, 50, 60 home runs or something like that. How big is he? I mean, big in terms of what he contributes to the team.
Well, let's put it this way, Anthony. The man has 30 home runs. That's a record for a Yankee rookie for home runs in a season. And we're barely past the midway point. DiMaggio hit 29. He's hitting .329. Only Earl Combs in Yankee history has had a higher average for a rookie. So, and those of who tuned into the All-Star game, and particularly the Home Run Derby, were treated to I mean, it was a mind-boggling spectacle. The engineers who constructed Marlins Park, Anthony, were insistent to the Marlins that no one would ever hit that retractable roof. Well,
Judge hit it.
Judge hit it.
Wow. Mike Vaccaro, are you back with us?
I hope so. Do I sound like I'm back?
You sound like you're back. It's good to have you. Thank you for your patience. So we were just talking about Aaron Judge and just how much he offers the Yankee lineup and sort of the excitement in general around baseball.
He's really been amazing. And, you know, it's the one thing the Yankees have been able to rely on from day one, which is amazing because he's a rookie. And especially because last year, you know, he had a propensity to strike out, get into huge slumps. And while he still strikes out at a pretty good clip, the balls he gets in play tend to find their way either way over the fence or they hit so hard that fielders can't get to them. It's been a remarkable thing to watch. It really has been.
So I want to ask you both, and Mike, I'll start with you. I mean, I want to ask you about this potentially important series between the Red Sox and the Yankees and about this rivalry, because I feel that once upon a time, a mid-season series like this would have generated a lot more excitement and hype around it. Do you think has the sort of white hotness of this rivalry cooled off for some reason? You've written about it. What do you think?
To a degree, and I think the problem is that there's not as much familiarity between the combatants as there used to be. I mean, when you look back to, you know, just the most recent conflagration, which is 03, 04, that era, you know, these teams are playing each other not only 38 times a year, or, you know, 19 times a year, but all in the playoffs every year. And it happened year after year after year. So, I mean, you know, New York hated Pedro Martinez.
Right.
I think Boston probably despised Alex Rodriguez. And these weren't things that were instantaneously hatched. They were born out over time. You know, in the same way that Thurman Munson and Carlton Fisk had a rivalry, DiMaggio and Williams had a rivalry, these things had to brew. While the uniforms are the same, I don't think that Boston has been able to generate a real hate for Aaron Judge just yet. Now, that might change depending on his production this weekend. And I think similarly, you know, when it comes to New York, it's not like booing Manny Ramirez and Pedro Martinez anymore. It's, you know, Chris Sale is a guy. It's going to take a little bit for guys for the guys in the bleachers to really generate a distaste for him, I think.
Yeah. Gordon, how do you see this rivalry? Has it cooled off a little bit?
Well, it's clearly not the Red Sox versus the evil empire
right
these days. I do think it's cooled off, and I think part of it is the fact that, you know, the Yankees haven't won it since 2009, and there were a lot of anonymous guys wearing pinstripes in recent years. But that's what I find encouraging, Anthony, is that rather than launching into an extensive rebuild. It looks like the Yankees are turning things around a lot quicker than anyone anticipated. So you have both teams having a core group of young, potentially very exciting stars. And I think some of that familiarity that Mike is referring to, Red Sox fans could rattle off the Yankee lineup just as easily as they could rattle off the Red Sox lineup in 2003, 2004, and we may be headed back toward that.
Interesting. Well, Mike Vaccaro, how important is this weekend series, these four games, and what are you looking for? What's exciting you about it?
Well, I think it's important for the Yankees because they've been playing so poorly recently. They've gotten 15 games over to four games over, from four games, you know, essentially four games ahead of the Red Sox or four games behind the Red Sox. And I think they really need to reestablish in their own minds that they belong in the same fields as the Red Sox. The Sox were kind of the favorites coming in, and rightfully so. The Yankees played above their heads for a long time. I think this is a great opportunity for the Yankees to prove to themselves that they belong to be in the conversation for the division and to announce they're going to be in it for the long run. You know, conversely, I think it's an opportunity if the Red Sox were to win three out of four, I think the message it sends is that maybe they're about ready to chase the Yankees out of the race.
All right. Well, that's Mike Vaccaro. He's the lead sports columnist for the New York Post and author of Emperors and Idiots, 100 Years Rivalry Between the Yankees and the Red Sox from the very beginning to the end of the curse. Mike Vaccaro, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend and enjoy some baseball.
It was my pleasure. Have a great weekend, guys.
And Gordon Eads, lead historian, longtime sports writer, lead Red Sox historian. Gordon, great to have you. Have a good weekend.
You too, Anthony. Thank you.
And that's it for today and for this week on Radio Boston. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.